Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements with black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coins, hell pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz, Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit won't be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coins, hell pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Good morning, good day, and good evening to everyone, wherever you are watching this third day of the People's Court of Public Opinion's grand jury investigation into the corona problem. Yesterday, we heard a group of experts who explained to us the geopolitical and the historical backdrop of what we are dealing with and what some of us are suffering from today. Today, we will take a closer look at the PCR test, which is at the foundation of everything we are seeing. But before we start today's session, Judge Rui will give a summary of what we learned yesterday.
Thank you, Reiner. Summary of the second day of the grand jury investigation of the Court of Public Opinion. Yesterday, on February 12, 2022, This court of public opinion, with the help of a number of experts, took a look at the background against which this corona pandemic is playing out. Three experts from the UK, Alex Thompson and Brian Gerrish, both former employees of British Secret Service, explained together with Debbie Evans that the real power behind, the real power center behind everything that is happening is completely independent, even independent of England and London, City of London, and the criminal financial industry that has emerged there is now spanning the globe. Everything emanates from it and its fifth column, Wall Street in the US. This more applied name and financial mafia was, for example, responsible for a straight bus and first and second world war, and in each case they financed both sides of the conflict. Terrorism and drug trafficking were also invented by the City of London's financial mafia. It makes money from these too. This financial mafia is run by a small group of families. Through this highly criminal organization, other private parties, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, have gained control of healthcare first in England and then worldwide. Healthcare is being used as crowbar by these left-appointed elites. With the help of one of the most important platforms of this group, the WEF, and politicians bred through the Global Young Leaders Program of the WEF, they strive to gain power, total control of the world population, because in this antisocial and anti-human view of the world population are fewer beings not any more relevant for them than cattle. Matthew Eard from Canada and Whitney Webb from the USA explained to us that Canada is still completely under the control of British Crown. That's why Justin Trudeau, a project of Global Young Leaders Program, took the oath of office explicitly swearing allegiance to the British Crown, namely to Queen Elizabeth. In the United States, however, things are different. Their Anglo-American world dominance, as envisioned by City of London, London's financial mafia, has not caught on. There's two systems now exist in the U.S. One is the system of those who want to separate themselves from plunderers and debt-ridden Europe, and especially the City of London, and the other is the so-called deep state, led by Henry Kissinger, among others, who continues to pursue precisely this old world domination. The role of Chinese leadership could be that of expanding the social credit system, first tried out there in China, to the entire world. James Bush, a retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel whose duties had included overseeing bio-level 3 and 4 labs in the U.S., used the exercise of Operation Dark Winter, in which he himself participated in 2001. Luke Steph by the Rockefeller Foundation, and finally, Event 201 from October 2019 to explain that financial mafia had been planning for at least 20 years to use this crowbar of health to stage the pandemic panic. Precisely what was financially rehearsed in October 2019, like a dress rehearsal, has been implemented since the beginning of 2020. Dr. Silver Verhand and Dr. Astrid Stucker-Belger, who both used to work for WHO, explained to us that this financial mafia has now not only taken the extensive control over the WHO, but also over the UN, and through the world's WHO floating rules and regulations, which have no democratic legitimacy whatsoever. And its own constitution, which has no democratic legitimacy whatsoever either, and national legal regulations and constitutions are effectively suspended or will be soon. In fact, only private parties, in particular the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, determined the course of the WHO in January 2020. There were practically no cases for the start of the long-planned corona pandemic, but cases is what they needed for declaration of a public health emergency of international concern, because that's the only basis on which it's possible to use untested new drugs on humans. Therefore, they created these cases artificially with the help of the PCR test of one of Mr. Christian Drosten of Charité Hospital in Berlin. None of the many people infiltrated by these financial mafia into what they think are strategically important positions in politics, medicine, media, and judiciary, and of course, medicine all around the globe. So this was this is a summary of what happened in the second session of the Court of Public Opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Rui de Castro. This leads us right into the discussion of the PCR test, as this is at the foundation of all the measures, as we will soon find out. We will start by looking at the meaning of the PCR test within the system of the World Health Organization. Dr. Stuckelberger will explain a few details.
Yes, thank you, Reiner. I want to say first that the WHO has never, ever used the PCR from the International Health Regulation in 2005 until the swine flu, where Drosten started to come into place already and tried his crime. The PCR is some technology which replaces the doctor. And if you can compare, and that's what I do often, I compare what has happened with SARS-CoV-1 compared to SARS-CoV-2. SARS-CoV-1 was not at all managed by a technology. It was the symptomatology that was counting, and the doctor and the medical doctors were at the center of the validation process. And this is what disappeared completely with SARS-CoV-2. The other thing that is very different is that in the International Health Regulation implementation course that we run between 2009 and 2013, we had guidelines to how to validate and how to identify. It's a very important process to when you have an outbreak. And what is an outbreak? Well, the first thing is that you have to, with WHO, it has a shock room. It's called shock. It's a strategic health operation room. And every morning, they look at the messages, and they look if something is suspicious, not just coronavirus, which is a common flu. And from then on, they have to have a process of validation, not only if it is a biological infection, but a zoonotic, or is it a foodborne, or chemical, or radionuclear, or irradiation. So we had a guideline, and I can just, so what we see how different it is with this PCR, we had, and it was validated by all the experts of WHO, because I was running the exercise of case studies for those four typologies, and it's first the description of circumstances, then you have to identify and characterize chemicals, infectious or toxic agents of public health concern internationally, and then you have to describe the ways people come in contact with the chemical, the infectious, toxic agent, and the timeline of the toxicity, the effect on humans, validated many times, the nature, animal life, water, food, environment. Then the fourth thing to do is characterize the health risk, and that's called risk assessment, and there are lots of documents on this related to the exposure, how much time which of the first strain of the common flu, and I'm coming to that, and as well as the duration, what treatment eventually, what is the risk they spread at the international level, and become a public health emergency of international concern. This doesn't happen overnight, you know, from the 22nd of January to the 16th of March, when Fauci got an email that he had to lock down everything. It is documented. So this is the first thing. Now, what we had as a process, and I have a kind of a decision-making tree, there is an annex 2 of the International Health Regulation, which everybody has to go through. But before that, they have to have a case zero. In Ebola, and you can look at many films like Outbreak with Dustin Hoffman, that was an exercise we did with the students, there's always a case zero. Where is the first case? And we have, it's called COVID-19, but where is exactly the description of the case zero? People have to think about that. No, it has not taken place. There's still doubts, and now we know it is man-made, but it took a long time. So that is the first thing. Then you have to go through a very known procedure in science called the Koch postulate. And the Koch postulate is something to be validated at the international level if we want to use something at the international level, like say it is the virus COVID-19. And it has, the Chinese claim they have done it, but there was a lot of criticism from many academic institutions that two parameters have never been really analyzed, and it has to be analyzed again and again, not just in China, but each country should do that. Well, it is the contagiosity, and it is the causality. And a causality is very important. In fact, it has to be done again and again. It's not just a PCR test that decides the future of humanity, which is completely crazy compared to what the international health scientific process and procedure is in detecting, identifying, detecting, and validating and verifying every time, again and again. So that's really the first parameter. The second is that this PCR test in lab, there are directives and guidelines that were posted early 2020 of how to proceed exactly with a PCR test. And already then, there was a possibility to have the ELISA test, and the doctor was recommended to validate this PCR. Then as the time went on, from January 2020, where also the CDC had already warned and had the document that PCR test does not work, it is not there to monitor an epidemic, neither to validate an infectious disease clearly. Well, what WHO did is that they made an alert product. PCR test is to be looked at with caution, but it was hidden in the website of WHO, and there was one in December 2020. It was, I think, the third or fourth alert, and then again in 21, and it said that every country who uses PCR test should write down on the result the amplification cycle clearly, but that they they were very vague about the validity of that. So that is for the procedure. I just want to say it has nothing to do with what we have in the International Health Regulation as an obligation. Every state that we had, we were training had sovereignty in how they were managing their epidemic, because it's an epidemic, and then it's a pandemic, and it's not very clear at what moment it is a pandemic. And this has not been in SARS-CoV-1, just to remind you, it's a common flu that disappeared after 8 months. 24 countries were touched, 787 dead from this coronavirus 1, and 8,000, 6,000, etc. Sick from that. So when you compare SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2, there is something totally wrong. The other thing is that since SARS-CoV-1, experts and international scientific teams have tried to develop a vaccine, absolutely unsuccessful over 20 years. So how come suddenly there is the development of a vaccination in one of a synthetic experimental vaccination when all the things, all the vaccination development of coronaviruses have failed? Why? Because the coronavirus mutates all the time. And you cannot do a vaccine when something mutates. So that's a point I want to underline. WHO was never a seller of vaccines or a seller of medication. This was almost against the objective of the World Health Organization and not the World Disease Management Organization. So it has transformed. You can see this now in something completely different. And I will maybe finish by saying that I found something very interesting for you. First, another thing is that, in fact, the PCR test, it's not just the test. It's the way it is applied, I think, that should be discussed. Because why put it in the nose so deep, cracking down the most sensitive part of the pre-brain and the layer between the brain and the rest? One clue is that, in fact, test PCRs can vaccinate people, because this is how veterinarians are vaccinating animals. Even Egyptians were doing that, apparently. But you can talk to, animal doctor, veterinarians. They put a swab very deep into the nose of the animal to vaccinate them. So we can ask the question also about the procedure, the quality control of this procedure. Now, we know that on those swabs are not neutral, and there are nanoparticles and a lot of, I'm sure the experts are going to talk about it, a lot of very toxic and things that have nothing to do there. And actually, the test doesn't need to go in this nose. Why did Drosten decide to do that? So the last little scoop I have now is that actually the conflict of interest of La Charité with the vaccine world is that there has been 3 payments from Gavi to La Charité between 2018 to 2020 that we have found. One was in December 2019. The Division of Global Health of La Charité, University of Berlin, received $86,000 for a grand topic on pneumonia 4 months. So that's nothing. But then in October 2018, grand topic, the Global Health and Development Public Awareness and Analysis, a duration of 14 months from October 2018, $550,000 to Global Policy and Advocacy of Charité Berlin. And the last one in March 2020, but there might be more, was to support innovative technology solutions. From March 2020, they got $249,550 for a duration of 40 months. So there is clearly a conflict of interest, like the Imperial College also got $79 million, gosh, for malaria program. So it's in the same files. So we can see there that there is a big conflict of interest also with Drosten, with Gavi. We have to follow the money. That's where it goes. And maybe the last thing is that I found out what is Drosten doing at the moment, because it's always interesting. He's involved in something that I know since a few years. It's called the World Health Summit. It happens in general in Germany, and it is 3 days. And there, the heads of La Charité and those behind are getting together with WHO, with Gavi. Drosten is there, the University of Geneva is there, and the Hospital University, because Ilona Kickbush, who is retired but is still active illegally at the University of Geneva, is the one who's preparing the WHO treaty that we talked about yesterday, the pandemic treaty that wants to take over with the WHO constitution, implementing a world constitution, because we have such a horrible pandemic that they are doing a new governance, and they're preparing this at the WHO extraordinary health assembly that took place in November, December 75th, extraordinary, the second extraordinary in the history of WHO. And they also discussed this at the executive board and are planning for the World Health Assembly third week of May this year to discuss this and maybe even make it happen. So it's good that we are here together. And I also want to say, as there are people listening, that this pandemic treaty is something that would take citizens' rights away. The constitutions would no longer operate. And an NGO from Russia, an association of citizens, have already written to WHO and probably, I hope, to their Minister of Health to say that they don't agree with this pandemic treaty.
Astrid, thank you. The first question seems to be coming from Virginie. You have your hand up, Virginie.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Zuckerberger, for this important element. I would like to know if at least one country could have questioned the quality, the validity of these PCR tests that were developed very fast. And it seems that no one has tried to question this product.
It's a very good question. Normally, member states can, of course, they're in the international health regulation, the sovereignty was respected in the way that there were just two countries that is reserved. There are articles in the legal articles in this international health regulation, which is, I want to recall, binding for every member state. You can do reservations, and there is a procedure and timing for that. So it seems that if it happened, we don't know about it. But what I know is that there is some link to Dr. Fauci, because Dr. Fauci received a proposal to replace the PCR test in one of his many emails. And I have people following me and helping me. And one, Nadia just sent me this, and it's Anita Gael writing to Anthony Fauci on 26th of February 2020, proposing a much more efficient detector diagnostic tool called Gene Radar platform for mobile, and it was turned down by Fauci. So, and apparently they put all the data behind. So I think there have been attempts, but at the, you know, personal level, but it seems that this is much bigger network than just WHO. Frankly, I don't think that the Director General, Tedros, is really, you know, directing it, because normally when there is a pandemic, there is a pandemic team that speaks to the media. What you hear now is only Tedros and a few media people. So we don't really know the reality if some countries have resisted, but I know that Madagascar has tried to pull out of WHO a few times, so it's they could, of course. I mean, according to international health regulation, of course they can. But what we discussed yesterday is, if they have an epidemic law, or if the country has changed its constitution, or if the country is registered as a company, which we have seen with many countries, well, of course, the people don't know, and the people don't have any knowledge that they can refuse and that their government would protect them. And maybe that's the key issue, is that now that people will know, they can react, and we will help them, I hope, to make a resistance to this PCR, which is still used and promoted by this International Atomic Energy Agency, which, I remind you, is an agency that's very powerful, because in WHO, it is managing all the radionuclear events before WHO. It has a contract with many UN agencies. I looked at it this morning. Not only WHO, but UNESCO, the Food Administration Organization, FAO, and many others. So the people, we have to really react to all this political Ponzi scheme just to take our liberties away.
Thank you, Astrid.
Thank you, Dr.
I'm sorry, Virginie. Is there a follow-up question, or is it Anna who is next?
I think I am next, yeah. Rainer. Thank you.
You muted yourself.
Dr. Zuckerberger, That was very good. Thank you. Are you aware that the Prime Minister of Tanzania had asked the World Health Organization to leave his country after he tested various non-human subjects on the PCR test, for example, a fruit, the papaya fruit, a goat, oil, that sort of thing, and found that it was a positive test. And he immediately denounced the PCR test and that he subsequently died under mysterious circumstances. Were you aware of that history?
I'm aware that a few presidents have resisted and they died. Yeah, I think he's not the only one. I didn't know the story of the PCR behind. Probably there is more than the PCR because anybody resisting this gang of pirates have disappeared or even carry mules. So, yeah, I don't know more, but that's a good answer, yeah, a good example.
And I have a follow-up question, too. Of course, Terry Mullis was the one who invented the PCR test to begin with in terms of being able to multiply minute amounts of DNA to be able to detect it by amplifying the DNA. And it was used primarily in forensic settings, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Carrie Mullis was a researcher, and so am I, basically. So he was saying that it's a very interesting tool for research in the lab because you know what you're studying, so you are looking for what you know, but you're looking a bit deeper. But he said that in no circumstances can this be amplified, and I think Ulrike put it in her first page, in no way can we diagnose anything. It's like a big soup, and we cannot make, it's not a diagnostic tool. And he went many times against Dr. Fauci to resist, already with HIV/AIDS.
Yes. Neil, and the last question I have was, do you have or know of any evidence that, whether direct or circumstantial, that would show that Drosten knew of the fraudulent nature of the COVID-19 test, PCR test?
No, I cannot think of anything now that would incriminate. I can only see that he has ties with Gavi early on. And as Gavi was the big planner of this whole global vaccination campaign that is killing people and making them sick, I would imagine that's the link that I would really look into to prove that he knew.
All right, thank you. I'll ask the other experts to see if they have any as well. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
If I can add something, I think Dr. Drosten knew that it was not a good tool since at least 2014, because it was a newspaper article about that when he worked on the MERS-CoV. He already stated that PCR tests were too much sensitive, and it was not a way to follow the virus. It was really too much sensitive and amplified by media already in 2014. So.
Yes.
In that article, he explained that a positive test result doesn't mean a thing because this test, it tests positive on perfectly healthy people. And he was talking about a nurse back then. I'm sorry, Mike, I didn't want to interrupt you.
Yes, I was really going to make the point you just did. He used a phrase like, this technique can show a positive result even if a single copy of the virus was fleeting across the respiratory mucosa of a nurse. He used a phrase like that. So, you know, that's important. And did he know? Well, he's a co-author of the foundational test, which we call the Corman-Drosten test. So he put forward a test, which then the WHO proposed in his famous test speech. So that was the test he was talking about. And also, we may or may not cover it, But Drosten is a co-author of the test, the variants of which have been used around the world. But he knew, per the statement we've just referenced, that it's if used with inadequate constraint on amplification can give positive results when people are not sick and not infectious. But it's also worth saying that, and maybe a colleague will say this in the wrap-up, but the inappropriate use of PCR and the asymptomatic transmission, the idea that people with no symptoms can infect others, which is not true, it's epidemiologically rare and irrelevant. Drosten was also in Europe the absolute center of promoting this very idea, which seems a remarkable coincidence, does it, that he's the author of a technique now used around the world, which he knew was not appropriate, that's PCR, and he's also, he was the biggest expert on TV telling us all about this asymptomatic transmission. So you can decide for yourself, but for this same expert, an advisor to Angela Merkel for years, happens to be point center of two of the absolutely crucial parts of these sort of mendacious, the lying about this whole pandemic, strikes me as more than coincidental.
Absolutely. Dexter, you have your hand up.
Yeah. Good day, Dr. Spickelberger. Thank you so much for your evidence. What I'm going to pose to you now, in seeing that we are talking about crimes against humanity, the evidence that you have just given, and you can actually tell me as to whether it is correct, that is that when one actually compare the regulatory, World Health regulatory operations or procedures between SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2, one can clearly actually see there is huge discrepancies. And those specific discrepancies, and you've actually mentioned something very important when it came to SARS-CoV-1, and that is symptomology itself. And symptomology, which was not a prerequisite when it comes to the testing of SARS-CoV-2, but why not? It's because why the regulatory procedures has changed. So I put it in to you, Dr. Stuckelberger, one can then clearly say that that actually shows a criminal intent from the World Health Organization and all the specific parties that's actually behind the World Health Organization. Will you agree with me with that?
You're muted, Astrid.
I did an article, actually you can find it, in a scientific article in May 2020, ACTA Biomedica on international health regulation and uncertainties. At that moment, I already had doubts, but now I think we have to add this injection, and I would agree, because the end of the game there is, for them, is to inject toxicity that is a chemical and maybe irradiation level and not just mRNA, etc. So, yes, the real crime is that people are dying not because of something we have not identified really clearly and that a PCR has wrongly identified with cases which are asymptomatic, and this is criminal already, but it is really that the end point they're doing now is changing and editing the genome, and they're very clear about it. WHO, two last big, before this treaty came out in July, is recommendation for genome editing. But it's much more than the CRISPR. It is going into changing who we are. And it is against the convention of Oviedo, of medicine, of all the declaration of Helsinki, of all the ethical and regulation on keeping our heritage intact. In that way, it is definitely a crime against humanity, as we are, by their treatment.
Thank you so much. Just a follow-up question to that. And that is that when we actually now compare once again SARS-CoV-2, and I would like the jury to really reflect on this, because why I believe that it is at the foundation of what we are currently dealing with when it comes to crimes against humanity. We've got SARS-CoV-1, which means there is a precedent that one can actually work from, and now we have SARS-CoV-2. Having regard that you have inside knowledge, you've actually worked for the World Health Organization, what will you say when it comes to the regulatory procedures for SARS-CoV-2? Do you actually see the need for the World Health Organization to have changed dramatically the health regulatory procedures compared to SARS-CoV-1? Because logically, it does not make sense. We've got something that we can relate to, which means that if we have to change something, it's just going to be something very, very minor. So I would like you to tell the jury that based on your expertise, your experience, your insight and knowledge as well, was there really a need to have actually changed this regulatory procedure when one compare it to SARS-CoV-1? Thank you.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, thank you. It gives me the opportunity to explain a bit further. The very important way for a country to identify that they have something to notify the focal, the IHR and focal point to notify, or the country or the epidemiologic center, is they have developed an algorithm in the Annex 2 of the International Health Regulation. Everybody can see it. Annex 2, you can go and look on the web, PDF. It's translated in 10 languages or so. This Annex 2 has four main questions, and I was teaching that at the university, at the summer school, to American schools. So it's really very important. Everybody can do it. The first, they have three boxes, and they have one box. If it is a disease, is it a disease? And they list the disease, poliomyelitis, and they have SARS, you know, a syndrome of respiratory acute syndrome. So this, if it is there, it means that it is known. So that's the first question. Is it known? Yes, it's known. We had SARS-CoV-1. And then the second, is it unusual or has it a different morbidity and mortality, etc.? And this is no, because we know now that in 2020, Professor John Ioannidis, the most cited, has even published on the WHO bulletin, it was in there, that there is no more mortality in 2020. So no, we know now. The third is, is there a risk of international spread? And you see that SARS-CoV-1 touched only 24 countries in 8 months. So if you compare, it was total lockdown in 196 countries in 1 month, and SARS-CoV-1 was 8 months. So the international spread was slow. It was not rapid, but they have pretended it's rapid. But this is it's very concerned for them. And the last one is, does it have an international a risk of stopping travel and trade? Because the International Health Regulation was put in place to precisely prevent the trade and travel restrictions. And here we have exactly the opposite. It's the only question where we could say, yes, it happened, because they put so much fear in their messaging and their communication, which is against the International Health Regulation training we had. We had somebody, an anchor from CNN, doing the course, and I was in charge also with that, and it has to be ethical communication, to be nice, to reassure people, say we are looking, we haven't found, we are looking more. And I don't know if you remember, in Germany in 2011, there was the Institute Koch came out with the cucumber killer. It was the Escherichia coli emergency outbreak, because there were three deaths. And they were saying every day, we don't know, we're looking. They accused the cucumber that had this Escherichia coli in Spain, and they stopped all the production of cucumbers in Spain and European Union. And in fact, it was not that. It was from a market in fenugreek in Egypt, and it came to Denmark, and people had lost all that money because it was an announcement that was wrong by scientists that were very careful. So what happened is that the European Union reimbursed all the peasants who lost the money because it was a wrong announcement. So this was one of the examples I took in my courses, because every situation is different. But here they have made a communication of fear and of lies, and this is how they managed to make people believe that this coronavirus, which was totally out and was not even existing in autumn, Professor Haus, who was looking at this with very careful. I was looking at, you know, really watching how he was sequencing the genome, and that's another way to look at it, although it's not enough. And he was part of the human genome effort internationally of COVID-19, and this was very scientific, but definitely we cannot say that this has been managed the same way that it should have. Am I answering your question?
Thank you so much. Dr. Fuchelberger, just in conclusion itself, so from an evidentiary point of view, and having regard that at the center even of this investigations, the grand jury investigations, it comes down to the Dawson PCR. So based on the evidence that was released yesterday as well also by Dr. Barrett, and you've also just mentioned in evidence now as well, the only reason as to why the World Health Organization could have actually declared a pandemic was simply because right now we are talking about spreading. And that spreading in itself has got a direct link with this false Drosten PCR. So at the center, you will agree then, or you can basically say as to whether you agree with the following statement. The statement is that Drosten should be held liable because it is as a result of his PCR, faulty PCR test, that the requirement of a spreading transmission, and hence why the FIEC, and hence why we're actually sitting with a pandemic. Do you agree with that statement, Dr. Stuckelberger?
Yes, I think he is one piece of the puzzle. It's him and La Charité University of Berlin, because the whole institution is behind him. And this, I know this from other universities. It's a system and a health system. So, yes, I agree. But I would not, I would take the whole institution, not everybody in the institution, but we cannot keep on having universities who are lying and are creating science that is fake. So if we only...
That is a political question, but Dexter's question is asking precisely, is he, as he's one of the putative defendants in this proceeding here, do you think that he should be held liable because he, as we have learned from the statements of you and also of Dr. Mike Yeadon, should he be held liable because he is the one who invented the test knowing that it was going to test positive on perfectly healthy people?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, okay. If we have the evidence of this, I don't have the letters he signed, et cetera, but yes, of course, considering this is the evidence.
Thank you very much. Let us now take a closer look at the PCR test itself. What can it do and what can it not do? Thank you, Astrid. Professor Kemmerer, please tell us, what can this test do? Can it really tell us something about infection or can it not?
So, well, I try to share my screen. I've prepared some slides just to give you a short information on the RT-qPCR, the basic principles. First, the definition, because a lot of persons still do not know what it means. So the test system used here for the detection of the SARS-CoV-2 genome is a so-called RT-qPCR. It's a reverse transcriptase quantitative polymerase chain reaction. So, and the main argument is the RT-qPCR for the detection of the SARS-CoV-2 RNA is technically not able to decide if a sample which is found positive is indicative of an infectious, contagious person. I will go into it. Even if performed under perfect conditions, that means if everything, I'll go to this, is perfect design. So the primers are correct, the temperatures is correct, the lab performance, the hand-on technique is perfect. This technique cannot be used as a gold standard as it is designed and as a basis for the non-medical action intended to stop the spread of a virus. Especially mass testing without clear controlled standard operating procedures, and they still miss in most of the labs, must result in inaccurate test results, especially the first WHO protocol, and the name Drosten was mentioned several times today. He is responsible for this first WHO protocol. It is very poor in the technical aspects. It's faulty and it's highly prone to the production of false positive results. So the definition of the PCR, it's a laboratory method. It's a perfect laboratory method if you want to amplify a specific section of a RNA from a small sample to an amount that is detectable and further characterizable, for example, to do the sequencing. It's used worldwide in nearly every life science lab to do expression analysis, to do research. So this technique is very spread around the world, and every molecular biologist, you must not have to be a virologist or anything else, everybody is working with this technique, knows that it is limited and that the current use of it for this mass testing is definitely not a good idea. So the Q and the quantitative version of the RT-PCR, this defines a modified technique which allows to monitor the amplification steps. So every step is monitored by a light signal which is produced in every amplification round. However, the problem is that it does not allow the further characterization of the PCR product, like sequencing, and needs very careful development and proper controls in every single step. And this is often missed in the labs which perform the mass testings of the public. The RT-PCR, so the normal RT-PCR, is commonly used nearly in every life science lab, as I told you. And the PCR, so the amplification of DNA, is a basic method which was intended by Carrie Mullis, and nowadays is predominantly used in labs for forensic diagnosis, for example, to establish genetic fingerprints and crime scenes to identify the offender. Before I come to the technical point, I think what is most important in the question who is responsible to misuse the PCR is a timeline, because the main question is, why did the WHO wait for the Drosten PCR protocol and promote it? So why the scientists in Wuhan had everything at the end of 2019 and shared the information with the WHO before the first protocol version of Drosten. So this is a timeline Drosten gave in a talk, it's official, together with his Zoom picture. And here you see he marked his findings. So in January the 13th, the first protocol version from him was sent to the WHO, the modified second protocol version was on the 17th of January, and his so-called full paper in Eurosurveillance was published in January 23. So if we compare this timeline, there's nowhere mentioned the work of the scientists in Wuhan. If we compare this to the timeline found in a talk from the Chinese CDC on the timeline in Wuhan, you see here that they identified the first full genome of the new virus already as early as January the 3rd. And they mentioned a specific RT-PCR was developed in January the 4th. And here, in January the 11th, they noticed they have a commercial RT-PCR detection kit, which is distributed to the Hubei province, where Wuhan is the capital of. So, and this star indicates where Drosten provided his first protocol to the WHO. So on January the 1st, the scientists in China had a complete PCR and informed the WHO latest here at January the 9th. So why did they wait for Boston to step into the scene? So this is a PCR from the scientists in Wuhan. It's two genes different from the later published Boston protocol, but it works very well, and it's the same principle of a quantitative RT-PCR. In the tandem, another very interesting aspect is this quote from a publication from Slovenia, because they quoted in their publication, after extensive evaluation, our laboratory implemented light mix-based SARS-CoV-2 testing on the 17th of January. So how did it come that a lab in Slovenia had a commercial test kit which is based on the so-called Drosten Quammen primers and had this data sheet? This is the original data sheet accompanying the commercial kits from the Tipmol Bio company, which is sold exclusively via the Roche company and works on the Roche platforms. And if you go to the metadata, it's this sheet is produced by Olfert Lanz, the head of Tipmol Bio, and produced in the 15th of January 2020. So the whole commercial kit was ready, as it seems, latest the 15th of January, even after the first version of the WH protocol. So this is a remarkable timeline, which normally, especially since there is a SAP number of Roche, is highly unusual, let it say like this. So if you change the timeline by Christian Drosten, here at January the 15th, officially Olfert Lanz prepared the document I've shown you. And on January the 17th, this lab in Slovenia has implemented the mix, a commercial complete mix, and they mentioned after extensive evaluation. So an extensive evaluation is not able within 2 days. So they must have the commercial kit somewhere else. But there's no documentation why there was a commercial kit available so early, even before there was any international concern. So, and here, this is a Drosten paper. He published it after his primers were already in a commercial kit, but this is a scientific misconduct, which is a side effect. So this first test, this is for one of the three genes, not tested for diagnostic procedures, but it was used for diagnostic procedures. So this is a SAP number, so normally it uses in such a large company a lot of testing to get into the system. And one important point is that here they correctly added a positive control and assigned that it must be a CP, which is corresponding to the cycle threshold, the CP of around 30. So at this point, the new 30 must be the cutoff for the PCR. So, however, here amplification of a CT, CP is the same, up to 39 is the positive rating. So here they had in this protocol a much too high CT already. So independent of every PCR, if it's a charity protocol, if it's a CDC protocol, if it's a protocol from any other institutions, the main problem is false positives. And just to give a few points, false positives can be triggered by the bad PCR design, which is the case in this PCR from the Charité, the Quammen-Drosten protocol. They contain non-specific primer pairs and probes. it's bad conditions for the reaction itself. The temperatures, especially in the Common-Drosten protocol, are not appropriate. And in case of the quantitative PCR, if the CT is too high. So the design produces, in this case, false positives. But independent handling issues in the labs performing this technique. And the most problematic is everybody working with the PCR knows this is contamination of materials with positive control samples or positive PCR end products, which is most common. And the cross-contamination from positive patient samples into negative samples due to aquapipetting techniques or aerosol production is very common as well. So, and even the first protocol data sheet knows this because here is a note, opening this vial may cause contamination of the workspace. And once you have contaminated your workspace, then nearly every sample gets randomly positive when one of those positive samples gets into the reaction chain. And the last point I want to give a short overview is the question, does a proba perform? So if everything works well, if the design is okay, if the handling is okay, does a proba perform and positive RT-qPCR can indicate infectiousness? So, and in principle, neither a PCR or an RT-PCR or an RT-qPCR is technically able to decide if a sample which is found positive is indicative of an infectious or a contagious person. So why? The problem is a technique. The technique of the preparation of the samples, it needs to destroy all biological structures in order to separate the nucleic acid, in case of SARS-CoV-2, it's RNA, to make it accessible for the enzymes who perform the amplification. So if this scheme, this is from a publication, shows the extraction of the RNA of SARS-CoV-2 to make it available to amplify it in the PCR. So you have your swab, and then you dilute the swab in this solution. And this solution here, lysis inactivation of the sample is here the heading. So this is a... From this point on, all active material is destroyed. It is inactivated. So if you extract the RNA from swabs, it definitely needs a complete denaturation of any biological material into macromolecules. Now, this step corresponds to this step. So then you have a combination of RNA, of the genome of DNA, for example, from the cells you have in the swab, and you have proteins and lipids. And in this situation, you have neither an intact cell of the mucosa nor of any bacteria or fungi which are still in your nose and in your throat together with the viruses, and you can't have a virus particle. So there is no material left which is integer or viable or infectious. So the technique of RNA isolation is starting step of the RT-qPCR, which is used for the so-called detection of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. It's impossible to judge if the source of the RNA is complete, replication competent, infectious in case of a virus. So the same RT-qPCR result can be obtained as a positive result. This destroyed matter containing reminiscence of a further infection or an occasional virus, what Michael Yeadon said, which was inhaled from a patient and only stepping through the mucosa. So the main problem is the isolation of the nucleic acid for the amplification, and everybody, including Christian Drosten, who works with this technique, and every company preparing kits and advertising kits and every person advertising this technique, this RT-qPCR or even an RT-PCR for the detection of infectious persons had to know that is not able to do this.
I'm shocked.
I have a question. Dr. Stuckelberger and Professor Kämmerer. So yesterday, I think it was mentioned that WHO, they in the first attempt basically to declare it a pandemic, they had only 500 cases and then it wouldn't go anywhere. And then they waited for 10 days and then all of a sudden there were like 14 times as many cases. So could you set that in a timely perspective with the developments and the other things going on with the Drosten test?
Well, I think it's Sylvia who had all the numbers yesterday.
The information,
yeah,
that's right.
So I don't know them by heart. Sorry.
I think she said something like 500 cases, which
500
is...
500 cases, but we don't know the exact date again.
Mm-hmm.
So there was something on this slide, this timeline given by Drosten. There was exactly the lineup of the actual cases when he performed his PCR. And it was nearly, so one in China, one in South Korea, and so it was very few cases. And even the first cases in official cases in Wuhan, it was, they are published by Ren et al. And by other Chinese scientists. The first five patients in Wuhan, only one of them died, and this one had serious conditions because he had metastatic cancer. So even from the beginning on, it was definitely clear that this virus is not the killer virus as it was told to us.
Yeah, I remember it was 24. It was 24, the first number that Sylvia mentioned yesterday in January.
Mm-hmm.
Which is normal in WHO. You just go increasingly into a bigger number, but you don't go directly to, you know, numbers everywhere.
Mm-hmm. I have four questions. One is for clarification. You showed us in your timeline that the Corman-Drosten paper or the protocol, which was then recommended to the entire world through the WHO, Tedros, as the gold standard for testing for corona or COVID-19 infections. Before it was published, even before it was published, the test kits, which were produced by Drosten's business partner, Alfred Lund, with his company Tipmoy Biol, which is now under control of Roche because I think they bought it. But before they even published the paper, they sold their test kits to the entire world. Is that correct?
Well, not to the entire world, but nearly. There was a lot of test kits sent out. Alfred Lund even mentioned this in several interviews. And we know from other works that even the Roche company in combination with Tipmoy Biol started training of laboratory personnel in Africa and in Asia to use this test very early in the beginning of January.
Isn't that a gross violation? Don't we see a clear conflict of interest there? I mean, first you sell the product that you invented, and then you go out and publish something that actually calls for buy my product. Isn't that, I mean, it's not just unscientific, isn't that a gross conflict of interest that we're seeing here?
Well, sure. And in addition, they perform this test at the so-called Labor Berlin, which where Christian Drosten is the head of. And this was the largest lab in Germany. And in the beginning, they did all the PCR, nearly all the PCR testing, because they had the advantage of being set up very early before all the others could start. So there's at least two conflicts of interest, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Another question for clarification. Is it correct that no matter how you perform a PCR test, it can never tell you anything about infections because, one, it cannot distinguish between, this is unscientific speaking, of course, dead and live matter, and two, since the actual virus is completely destroyed before you put this swab into the machine, and the only way you can get an infection is by a complete virus entering the cells and starting to replicate. Is it correct that it is completely impossible, no matter how you apply a PCR test, that this PCR test can tell us anything about infections?
Well, that's a matter of definition. I think we should, it is allowed if the PCR is very correct and performed and the so-called threshold is very low. Then there might be a large number of viruses in this person, and if you compare it with a gold standard, which is a cell culture, then you compare it with an infection. But you never can judge if the person is infectious, so if it can transfer the replication-competent virus to another person. So the PCR is not able to identify persons which are the so-called super spreaders or transfer the virus. And this is the point in a pandemic. You should identify the persons who infect others. And the PCR is definitely not the technique for this aspect. So and now I've forgotten the first question.
So what this means is, we have to make very clear what we're talking about. The WHO needed cases in order to declare the public health emergency of international concern. Now, everyone thinks that a case means someone who is infected, meaning contagious for other people. But that is not what this test can do. No matter how you apply it, it can show that maybe there is a certain probability maybe of a person having a huge load of this virus. But even if this person, I will call this, is contaminated, because that's what the test finds, it still doesn't mean that this virus has entered the cells and is replicating so that the person becomes infectious, meaning contagious for other people. If that is the definition, then contagiousness can never be detected by this test.
Exactly, and the test cannot determine the disease, so the symptoms, because especially in respiratory viruses, it's normally a combination of different viruses. And if you search only for influenza virus, for example, the flu is called influenza. And if you search for rhinoviruses, then it's rhinovirus disease. And if you search for coronaviruses, then it's a coronavirus disease. So normally the MDs should decide the person has a disease. And if he or she wants to know which pathogen induce symptoms, then you can do a test like a PCR. But normally the MDs should start with symptoms, and then if you do, for example, a multiplex PCR, you might see that there's a lot of viruses. So even if the PCR can show you have a high load of this special RNA from this special virus, it doesn't tell you that the disease could not be from another virus, especially, for example, in the Wuhan, they have published that the most serious cases, it was always a double infection of the SARS-CoV-2 virus together with influenza B. Mm-hmm. So this is already known. So you have 3 to 4 viruses often in parallel. So and the PCR cannot say your disease is made by this virus and you can transfer this virus to another person.
Okay, so if someone tests positive, this only means that he has a he or she is contaminated. There may be a huge load even of this particular coronavirus, because that's the only thing it tests for. It looks for coronaviruses, so that's the only thing it finds. However, it cannot tell us if this particular person is infectious in the sense of contagious for other people. There is a possibility, but it cannot tell whether this particular positive test means that the person is infectious with COVID-19. The only way to find out what caused the symptoms, and I assume that it doesn't make any sense to test symptomless people, the only way to find out what caused the symptoms is by doing differential diagnostics. Is that correct?
That's correct, and that's the work normally of MD. So this is, I think, it's the first time in history that a lab test, a molecular lab test, does a diagnosis, and all the MDs get away from their normal job to do the diagnosis.
Here's the
because
final.
Because this test can't do this.
Here's the final question I have. You said that the Corman-Drosten protocol is very unscientific, and I'm trying to put this in, I'm trying to hold back the anger that I really have. Is it such a poor design because all of the people who worked on this protocol don't know what they're doing, or what does this mean?
Well, this is a good question. So either they really don't know what they do, but this can't be, because this is a so common technique and so simple, so they should know what they do, and especially those high cited experts and their large lab teams. It's not only Corman-Drosten, it's even Ulf Atlantis is on his publication, and his job is to produce RT-PCRs for commercial kits. So they all know exactly what they do, because nobody in this position cannot know that there are so many problems with this test design. So it must be intended.
So you would agree, since this test is so poorly designed, if you look at the totality of the evidence, we have a very poorly designed test. We have no cases before the test was publicized. Then, after the test was published, we have cases all of a sudden on which the World Health Organization bases its declaration of a public health emergency of international concern, which will then be the basis for using untested drugs on humans. Would you agree that this is very strong evidence for this having been used to create cases, to artificially create cases out of thin air? This is what I believe. Would you agree with that, or does it not make any sense?
No, it makes absolutely sense, because there's no other way to think about it.
Can I add something? So Drosten was, he was, as a testimony or expert witness, he was asked in a hearing by the German Land of Brandenburg in summer of last year. And he was asked, like, what kind of threshold he would consider as being reliable with regards to the PCR test. And he said we have that in stenographic writing because we had a witness in the hearing. And so he said it's around like 26. However, in his paper, he had suggested that it should be a threshold of like 43. So why did he never like work on like correcting his paper or like making this really publicly known, insisting as an advisor to the government that it would need to be, you know, changed? Because we can see that a lot of the PCR tests that were done were still in a very high range, so up to 40 and all that, causing all these, you know, fake results, the false positives, plus like leading to a lot of pain and damages, like with people going into quarantine without any reason. What can you say to that?
Would you, as a scientist, correct yourself once you understand that you've made a mistake?
Normally, yes, and especially in this case, we have written this a letter and then a very long review to the journal Eurosurveillance, where this fraudulent publication was in, and we wanted the retraction of this publication, which is normally the scientific procedure. And even here it was denied to retract the protocol. So, the reasons behind this, nobody knows. We only can speculate it, but normally we should ask Christian Posten why he is so unscientific working, not correcting his fraudulent PCR protocol. Mm-hmm.
Also, the paper, I don't know, I think you have not mentioned this yet, was rushed through the peer reviewing process in a very surprising time. Can you maybe comment on that?
Yes, we have analyzed this extensively. It could have been not more than 24 hours, which is highly unusual for a scientific review process for a full research paper. So in case of emergency or for very, very excellent publications, it could be that the editor of a journal obtains the manuscript and agrees and says, oh, this is a great manuscript. But even then, it's this very short time of 24 hours between the submission of the publication to the review process and the publication of the paper. This is, let it say, quite unique in the world.
And I remember that you identified like a large amount, I think it was nine big mistakes basically in that paper. And some of them, like for instance the threshold issue, would have been, I imagine, so in your face that the peer reviewers would have immediately, even within like 24 hours, would have needed to jump on it and say, well, this is maybe not like a really scientific or like a fruitful approach to the in the essay. Is that correct?
Yes, and in addition, one of the main points is they mentioned that they needed to quickly design a robust diagnostic tool PCR, because this was such an urgent emergency case. Without having the information about the virus, but they had the virus because they had the sequences from Wuhan. And if it was so necessary to have a good PCR with controls and sequencing, they should have asked their Chinese colleagues because they had everything. And so there was definitely no need for this publication and for this protocol.
Mike, is there something you would want to add to this? I mean, I can. It's very disturbing to see someone working in such a not just unscientific but almost criminal way. Would you too agree that this looks like the test was designed to produce cases, meaning false positive cases?
Yes, I think, Dr. Kammerer has done a better job than I could possibly do. But I think not applying either in the introduction, certainly in the discussion, a series of caveats. This test was put together very quickly using the sequence that was supplied to their laboratory from Wuhan, and they must have worked, night and day, if we're to believe how they did it. So they must have known, or at least ostensibly, the idea was, here's a potential serious pandemic virus, so let's put together a test to help the world identify, who is infected and ill as a consequence, who might be infectious and should quarantine themselves. They knew exactly what the context was. This wasn't some esoteric, academic, idea. They knew that they were facing potentially, as they say, a pandemic, and they were putting together, as far as they could, as quickly as they could, a test that could be applied. Now, if I was in their shoes, I would know that the people who are going to be using this, all around the world, at best will be able to just handle a pipette and follow a formula. Okay, it won't be labs like my own if I was Professor Drosten. So I'd be thinking, I need to make this bulletproof so it can't end up producing lots and lots of false positives. But they didn't do that. It seems to me that they set the conditions where even if a lab like his own applied this this recipe, that they would have a high likelihood of getting positive results from clinical samples that didn't mean the person was ill because of this virus and was infectious as a result of the material detected. And furthermore, as a senior advisor to the German government for many years and a clever scientist, he knew all of those things. So he released into the world a technique which used as it was by only barely trained people, could only, as Dr. Kammerer has said, produce results that are really, I would say, at best, uninterpretable. Yes.
Dexter, you wanted to ask a question.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you for your evidence, Professor Kammerer. When you ended your evidence, you've made a very, very important point. And that point is that everybody who uses the PCR, it's in each and every country. So here specifically, we are looking at the medical regulatory authorities who have approved it in each and every country in lockstep. And your evidence is that they were supposed to have known that there's no way that it can be used as a diagnostic tool. I would just want you just to say yes or no, just to confirm that and get it on record.
It could not be used as a diagnostic tool to rate about contagiousness, yes.
Okay, so contagiousness. And it was contagiousness when we actually didn't have regard to the evidence that was led yesterday by Dr. Berendt and even by Dr. Stuckelberger, that the only way for them, that is the World Health Organization, to have declared a PIEC was because they had to fulfill the requirements of transmission, and transmission comes down to contagion. Is that correct? Okay, I want to read the following into the record, Professor Ulrike, and I would like you to basically just comment. It is what I'm going to read. It is a statement that Professor Christian Drosten has actually said, and that is in 2014. It's an article in 2014, and where I am getting it from, I'm getting it from your peer review that you have actually co-authored. And it is basically referred to as the Kuhn-Drosten peer review. And I want to read the following into record. And this is what he has said in article in 2014, open quote, "The method is so sensitive that it cannot detect a single genetic molecule of the virus. If, for example, such a pathogen flies over the nasal mucous membrane of a nurse for a day, without becoming ill or noticing anything, then it is suddenly a MERS case." where previously terminally ill were reported, now suddenly mild cases and people who are actually very healthy are included in the reporting statistics. And I want us to focus on the word statistics. This could also explain the explosion in the number of cases in Saudi Arabia, Article 2014. So do you have any comment when it comes to that in relation specifically to your evidence that you have actually presented so far?
Yes, in 2014 he exactly described what is the problem with the PCR. So, and therefore he exactly knows that the misuse of this technique in the SARS-CoV-2 situation, in the current situation, produces exactly the same problems he described in 2014. So he definitely must have known that he promotes a technique to the world which is producing a lot of false positives and a lot of problems and a lot of false statistical cases. So he must have known it and he must have pronounced it against his own knowledge. For what reason ever?
Now continue. I just have a follow-up question, but you can quickly continue, Professor. Okay. The follow-up question is that you've mentioned now very clearly and is now in evidence, 2014, and that's basically based on what you said from 2014 up until 2020. And that is basically between the periods of the 22nd of January 2020 and ultimately the second meeting of the World Health Organization dated the 38th of January 2020. Is it correct to say that nothing has changed when it comes to the bare basics of the PCR test, whereby maybe perhaps he can actually say, you know what, okay, well, that's a statement I've made 2014, we are talking about 2020, this is what has changed, and therefore I justify that it can be used. Has anything changed scientifically, Professor?
No, as I have shown you, the technique is a basic technique. There's only minor combinations or other primers, but the basic technique and everything you can say with it is exactly the same since it was invented by Carrie Mullis and then improved by adding this quantitative version. So it is the same problem which was in 2014, which is now in this situation.
Okay, so now we're going to go back from 2014, we're going to go back to 2007, and that is the New York Times article. And let's this is once more as to, I'm reading it from your peer review, the Coleman Drosten peer review, and I'm quickly going to quote what he said out, open quote, "I had a feeling at the time that this gave a shadow of a hint of what it might be like during a pandemic, a flu epidemic. Yet, epidemiologists say one of the most troubling aspects of this pseudo epidemic is that all the decisions seem to be so sensible at the time." So now we've got 2007, this is a New York article, who basically made reference of a pseudo epidemic, also based on the PCR test. We've got 2014, we've got 2020, 2021, 2022, where we are at now, and you will agree that nothing has changed. So what is then applicable in 2007, 2014, and then 2020, 21, 22, it's exactly the same. Will you agree with that?
Exactly, because it's the technique which produces this problem.
Okay. Thank you very much, Professor.
Professor Dolores Cahill, we have spoken before. Is there something that, do you see this differently or would you agree with this, Dolores?
So I would agree entirely. I think I would have done hundreds of thousands of PCRs back in the 80s and 90s in the Max Planck Institute of Molecular Genetics in Berlin, and it's a very similar technique.
The only thing maybe I would add is that we should be asking, in all of our countries, we have virology labs and we have regulatory labs and we have the, you know, regulatory authorities that should also oversee the companies that are producing these tests as commercial products, and to be asking them for their positive controls and the negative controls. And also that the doctors, in a way, like with, just to follow up what was said, have to make a differential diagnosis. So they need to, and they should be using a technique called sequencing or Sanger sequencing of these positive, so-called positive tests to confirm that it really is SARS-CoV-2. Because if it isn't, the medical doctors have an obligation to then look for other infectious agents or agents that might cause the symptoms, whether it was an infectious agent causing pneumonia or if it is influenza virus or rhinovirus. So I just think, you know, as you all know, I've been studying the law for maybe 20 years, because immediately you go into what is the lawful basis of an accurate diagnosis and then who is responsible. So I would say the people that are responsible are the people who are giving these approvals for these testing. And they should be looking for positive controls, negative controls, and also checking samples from patients to validate the presence of the infectious agents by other methods, including directly from saliva or from mucosa, and then also to be sequencing the tests and to look at the positive and negative controls to confirm the diagnosis. And then the doctor should be saying, if this is a negative test and my patient has symptoms, there should be a series then of follow-up investigations to identify what is the causative agent so that they can give antibiotics or other preventions and treatments for the patient.
Thank you, Dolores. This leads us directly to the question of sequencing. And for this purpose, we would like to, I would like to ask Dr. Sonia Pekova, because we had an interview a couple of days ago, and then in this interview you told us that you found something very strange, which seems, in my view, to confirm that there's something wrong with the Drosten test. More than something, it tends to be a criminal activity that's been going on. You didn't do Sanger sequencing, Sonia. You did next generation sequencing, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And so first I'll answer and address your question, and then I'd like to go back also to the issues discussed previously, because I would like to offer a few comments on that. Mm-hmm. So regarding sequencing, when the wave started in the Czech Republic, so the first one in March 2020 was just small one, and it would have remained unnoticed if the media and journalists and stuff just didn't make the hype about that. And then the summer was completely clear of the virus, and it started abruptly again in September 2020. Then it was followed by another wave in November 2020. And then it was finally followed by a wave and starting in December 2020 and continuing till March 2021. Each of the waves behaved differently in the clinical terms. The first one in March was benign. The second one in September 2020 was also benign. And the next one in November and December was really something, and many people were ill, and many people unfortunately died, but not maybe all the time because of the virus, but also because of the mismanagement of the first-line therapy in the contact with the general practitioner, because there was almost no contact at that time. Everyone was scared of the virus, and the doctors just closed their departments, outpatient departments, and people didn't have appropriate care. But what we found out was when we started characterizing the individual waves, we found out that the original virus, which came from Wuhan, and we had the reference sequence, which was uploaded by the Chinese scientists in January, or late in January 2020, this was the wave in March 2020, but the second wave in September was something which was genomically slightly different. It contained mutations, many mutations throughout the genome, and this was possible to identify only using next generation sequencing because it has a throughput which is needed and you can sequence the whole genome from the beginning to the end. And we sequenced all our positive samples and needed to say that we analyzed almost 30,000 individuals, and all positivities were sequenced by our lab, either by Sanger sequencing or next-generation sequencing. The next-generation sequencing was used for the full characterization of the individual waves and of the individual viruses, which built the individual waves, and we found out that not only each wave, at least in the Czech Republic, not only each wave was created by different strain, but also the strains were not directly interrelated. So the first wave and started in September 2020 carried or had some mutation pattern. And we used this mutation pattern to follow up the circulation of the virus in the country. And at some point, starting in November 2020, the mutation pattern has changed, and the wave which was present here or circulated here in our country in November and December 2020 was genomically different. And interestingly enough, it lost many of the mutations from the wave from the previous wave, which is not possible. So this is not evolutionary possible. So if you have confined area, as our country was at that time, because the country was under lockdown, everyone was wearing a facial mask, and there was social distancing implemented into society. So we didn't see any respiratory diseases except for SARS-CoV-2, which really created three steep waves throughout the autumn 2020. And the subsequent wave was not the direct offspring of the previous one, which is not possible in a confined population. So now still there is a question in the air. So what was the source, or where was the source of the individual strains? And without next generation sequencing, you would not be able to identify the diversity, the genetic diversity between the individual waves. So it was not. So at the beginning, the narrative should be all the time it is the Wuhan virus. It starts and disappears, and everyone was startled. It was really mind-boggling because it was fear-mongering of the population by some virus which appears and disappears, and no one knows when. But then we found out that it was not the same virus. So all the time, it was something different. And if it was different in that way, that you have a wave and it has some mutation pattern because the virus accumulates mutations in time, that would be perfectly logical and possible. And then you would expect next wave, which would carry the mutations from the previous wave and might only add some more mutations because this is the normal evolution. But this was not the case. So the previous wave carried mutations, and the subsequent immediate wave just erased many of those mutations, and the virus is not able to erase mutations and return to the original blueprint. The virus does not know what the original Wuhan sequence was. So in my eyes, this implies that all the individual waves were totally was totally distinct, not directly interdependent. And as I said, I didn't know where the source of that might be. And also, each wave behaves clinically slightly different. So it's kind of orchestrated chaos, which was created. And as I said, using next generation sequencing, we are able to identify this trick. And to Omicron, for example, Omicron, which is this virus which is circulating right now, and it's really benign. So the Omicron, and it was also, I found it in the mainstream media, which is really something. If you find something in the mainstream media, they said that there is no direct predecessor of Omicron because it's so different from everything which we have seen here so far, that they do not know where is the origin of the Omicron. So we again speculate that it's lab, because in my eyes it's just laboratory leak and on purpose. So originally I thought it was maybe deliberately or some haphazard, I don't know what. But now it seems, and all the clues show that it's on purpose, and the individual waves look like it's not like normal evolution on a confined closed area, because you would see, as I said, one wave with some mutation pattern, then another raising from previous containing the same mutation pattern plus some more mutations till it will die. And with the Omicron, because it's so highly mutated, so I expect, because those creators of this pandemics already know that we know that we are able to sequence the strains and we are able to characterize the waves genomically. So they know that after Omicron, only if some other strain came, it only must have been more mutated than Omicron, because that is the normal evolution of the virus until it dies, until it will full of mutation, it will so infestated with mutation that the mutation will kill the virus at the end. So either Omicron is the last one, or if something happens, it must be more mutated than Omicron, and if Omicron is benign, the next one, if it comes, will have to be even more benign, almost unrecognizable, if we do not do PCR testing like mad all the time, because our governments want us to do that. So,
because when you say it, they're so distinctive. How come that the PCR test, where we, as I understand, do not have evidence that it was adjusted to the versions that are, circulating? So how come that it would, detect this kind of variety of virus versions as still being basically the old SARS-CoV-2? I mean, was it designed that way from the beginning, kind of, or what is your
That's a fantastic question, and thank you for that. So as we discussed on Friday when we met for the first time, I pointed to the interesting and weird thing with the design of Drosten, which targeted from the very beginning three parts of the genome of SARS-CoV-2. My job from 2006 is to design PCR assays, real-time PCR assays, and quantitative real-time PCR assays for whatever pathogen, because our lab is a large diagnostic lab, and we focus on both human and veterinary molecular microbiology. And 99% of the tests we have, and the tests meaning a quantitative real-time PCR test, either single or multiplex, is my job. I'm the designer of those tests. And I have been doing it from 2006, and it's my regular job. And all the time, always, when I do a new design for a new pathogen, I use bioinformatic tools and align the genome of the pathogen I'm just about to make an assay for, and align the genome align against all genomes in the database, in the worldwide database and National Center for Biotechnology Information. And I look for the most specific part of the genome of the pathogen, which is so specific and so unique that not other germ or pathogen in the world, or dog, cat, human, or whatever organism harbors this strand of DNA or RNA. And I do not remember one assay in our lab, and we have like hundreds of them, both covering veterinary and human pathogens, that we would use more than one one single unique target within the genome of a given pathogen. So when I saw the design by Drosten at the very beginning of the pandemic in March 2020, it was quite, I did not understand why he selected three targets. Because he only could go for one, as is normal. Just so, if you when you investigate, I don't know, hepatitis C, you have only one PCR targeting one specific portion of the genome of hepatitis C virus. If you investigate HIV, the same, just one portion, just one specific single portion, because PCR has to be specific and it has to be able to pull out only that target you are looking for. And Drosten decided to go for three individual targets, and it didn't make any sense for me at that point, but now I understand why probably he did it, because as we see that each individual wave was created by different strain of the virus, so it seems to me that he might, at the very beginning, have expected this heterogeneity within the SARS-CoV-2 family, and we know that coronavirus is mutated, but the speed at which SARS-CoV-2 mutates is unprecedented, unseen, unheard. And if you targeted only one portion of M gene or E gene or polymerase gene, you might easily miss some strain which might occur during the time, during some wave in some country. So making it safe side, if your task at the beginning for him was create or design a test which will not miss anything, might it mutate whatever, in whatever order, right? Please do that way, that you'll not miss anything. We need numbers. We need numbers, and we need to follow up each individual wave in each individual country. So if the task was this, and if I was in IOS order to make an essay for within this task, I would definitely go for three individual targets within the genome, maybe four, and I would make it so complicated just not to miss anything. For example, in our country, because we're doing a lot of veterinary molecular microbiology, we investigate coronaviruses in cats, dogs, parrots, horses, and each individual species has its own coronavirus, and we had the assays for years, and we never had any idea of changing or redesigning them, because they are perfectly, though the coronaviruses mutate, it's not so peculiar or hard or whatever that it would interfere with the diagnostics. So normally, although you investigate parrot coronavirus, you have the same assay for 20 years and you're perfectly happy with that. But for SARS-CoV-2, you needed many, many different assays to be able to catch all the individual strains of virus. And also it happened that I remember some notices from our government telling that when the British strain started, they said, oh, don't use this and that commercial kit, because this and that commercial kit is not able to identify the British or Alpha variant. So when Drosten designed his test in that complicated way, in my eyes, it implies for me, because I'm the designer myself and I have been doing for almost 20 years, in my eyes it means his task was to make it totally applicable for anything, no matter that you will identify something which is not SARS-CoV-2, that you have a huge background, many falsely positives and so on, because the question was, or the task was, not to make a PCR test which is specific. It was to make a PCR test which produces numbers. This was the question and the task. And if I might enlarge on this idea, and I think Judge Dexter asked maybe about that. So what was the difference between SARS-CoV-1 and SARS-CoV-2 in terms of official regulations? So in Europe and also in the US, because I traveled or I spent a lot of time in the US, and I know what kind of regulations they have in the US. We have something similar here in Europe. And in 2008 or so, a process started, which is called accreditation of laboratories. And accreditation means that you have in Europe, it's called ISO 15189, and it should show the quality of the processing of the samples in the lab and the quality of the whole management of the lab. But it also means that preferably the lab should use CIVD certified kits and not use so-called laboratory developed kits like some in-house kits. And when we started with this pandemic in March 2020, we developed our own PCR test because I was completely dissatisfied with the design by Drosten, and I said it openly also to our government that we are not going to use Drosten test because it looks dangerous. Probably it will produce a lot of false positives. It probably will have high background, and we developed our own test. We target and still do 5' UTR of the virus, which I think it's also so unique that it means it comes from the lab. But the majority of faculty hospitals in our country and also in Europe, because they run the ISO 15189, this accreditation system, they all the time tend to go for a ISO accredited kit. And here, I can show you, it's a box. It's a box. And this comes to your lab. It has a label saying CIVD. Seeing IVD is like a mantra for you, that someone has thoroughly validated the test before, hundreds of samples, because to get CIVD mark, you need to follow ISO 13485, which is an ISO for production of diagnostic kits, and you need to validate the sensitivity, specificity, variability, run hundreds of samples for cross-reactivity and blah, blah, blah. And once you have a box which is marked CIVD, so for the lab it means that if they use the chemicals within the box, even if there is some mistake, diagnostic mistakes, the blame goes after the producer of the kit and not after the lab. And this mantra is heavily used in faculty hospitals and big hospitals in our country and in Europe also. But if you have this kit, it's a black box. You do not know what the box contains. You get something from the manufacturer, and this specifically comes from Life River, which comes from Shanghai, China. So if there is something wrong with a kit, would you blame someone in China? Would you be able to blame someone in that country and negotiate what happens? And you have a box which comes with a novel super mix for SARS-CoV-2, enzyme mix, internal control, negative control, and positive control. And then you have a manual how to mix things together and investigate. And because you do not know what the constituents of the diagnostic kits are, you just need to rely on the reliability of the kit. But if the kit contains chemicals which are fraudulent, like all the kits or the absolute majority of the kits, at least at the beginning, was based on the Drosten design. So if you buy the kit because you want to cover your premises, you are ISO certified, you use only CIVD certified kits, so everything perfect for your government. But if you produce falsely positive samples, first, the blame is not on you. And second, you are not able to tell that you are producing false positive samples because you are not able to check if the positivity you are producing is correct or incorrect. You can't sequence it because you do not know the sequences of the primers and probes there. So, and the majority of laboratories are totally routine and they only need a box samples and run the test. So I think they misused the situation in the developed countries in Europe and in the USA, because everyone relies on CLIA or CIBD FDA accredited approved kits, whatever in the kit might be. So they didn't check for the quality of the diagnostics. They only check for the CIBD mark or FDA approval mark. And if the creators of the pandemics wanted to misguide everyone really hugely, so they would just produce diagnostic kits in China or somewhere in a province Zhuang, you would not be able to claim any troubles with your diagnostic kit because there's a language barrier or whatever, and you would produce numbers. So when we started with our homemade 5' UTR assay in our country, that it was under such a pressure, so it looked like our lab will be closed. They had so many objections against us, so this honested me, discredited me. So I didn't understand what's going on, because the 5' UTR assay is perfectly specific, doesn't have any background, does not produce falsely positive patients. I offered the test for free to anyone who might need it, and hundreds of laboratories from around the world asked for that, and I sent the assay to them for free. And it was theatrical from our government that they pressed us, wanted us to use the Drosten design. I said, no way, we are not using it because it produces falsely positive samples. So it's so, because the Europe and USA...
Hold it for 1 second, Sonia. Yes. You were told not to use that test which you had designed, but rather to use the Drosten-Korman test?
Yeah, at the very beginning, the absolute recommendation by our authorities was to use CDC or WHO recommended, highly recommended, excellent Drosten test. So first we bought the chemicals, we bought the kit, we bought it because I didn't want to be such a heretic in our country. But once I realized that the Drosten test is such a, could I say the word crap?
I guess that's what describes the test after having listened to all the testimonies from your colleagues.
The test is so incorrect, let's mm-hmm. put it like mildly. So I totally refused using it, and we immediately replaced the test with our in-house 5' UTR test, which was then accredited or validated using external quality control, first domestic, and then also international. And once it was accredited and validated using this external quality control testing, then our authorities just stopped criticizing us, to put it mildly again. And since that time, after Omicron, so since that time we continued with our 5' UTR assay, and I said we investigated almost 30,000 individuals, and with absolute accuracy, and so assay which is working and which is excellent, great, and fulfills all the requirements of ISO 13485, because when we design the assays, we also test them according to this European procedure. So I did not understand, still do not understand why people tend to use a test which is not correct. Except if you just need to accept the scenario that the main goal is not to be correct and precise, but the main goal is to keep creating numbers.
Can we, in concluding, would you agree that after we have heard from your colleagues and after what you have the conclusions that you have reached in your own research, would you agree that there seems to be absolutely no basis for any of the corona measures, in particular for the vaccinations?
Absolutely. So maybe first corona measures. So in our country and also in the European countries in America, over the world, they introduce this strict draconian anti-epidemic measures like facial masks, social distancing, quarantines, children are not allowed to school, and so on. But despite all these draconian measures, when we didn't see any respiratory diseases ever, we didn't see influenza A, influenza B, or respiratory syncytial virus, which are normally seen during autumn or early spring. Although all these draconian measures and everyone was locked at home and blah, blah, still the three waves of the coronavirus appeared, started, disappeared, despite any measures, So in my eyes, if you wanted to battle influenza A, so this was the way it really works, respirators or facial masks, but for SARS-CoV-2, nothing worked. Whatever you did, the wave simply smashed the country and smashed the country in a corrected, in a orchestrated way. So it was also announced a few months in advance that it will happen. So this is also, which I found extremely striking, how someone from the government could have known that, although it was like total, the virus was not present during the summer 2020, and they were able, based on some data, some non-existent data, they were able to predict that there will be a abrupt, quick, rapid wave in September. So from my expertise as a microbiologist, because I'm a medical doctor and have PhD from molecular biology, genetics and biology, and attestations from genetics and microbiology, so from the point of view of my background, to have a respiratory disease, a severe respiratory disease, normal, standard, naturally occurring, of natural origin, starting at the end of August, this is impossible. We didn't see it. We see first respiratory diseases starting in, I don't know, October, November, when we have this rain and this ugly weather, but never when we have beautiful sunny summer. So this was also interesting, and it was announced in advance. It started an unusual time, and the waves came as predicted.
So we come to the conclusion, if I understand you correctly, that there is no corona pandemic, but rather there is a PCR test pandemic.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Rainer, you were asking about vaccination, not to forget about that. So this is a really important point. So when we started sequencing those waves and we identified that each wave is something different, I did not hesitate and announce it openly to our authorities, to our government, what happened, what's going on here. And for the so-called experts, which give advice to our government, and it's all ill-advised, it's really ill-advised. The experts are something totally different. So those experts have expertise in immunology, vaccinology, and so on. And any immunologist or virologist or vaccinologist must know from his studies, because it's a standard textbook knowledge, that if you have a target, a virus, which is changing so much, it is not possible. It's contraindicated to use one single vaccine, which was designed against the virus which escaped from Wuhan and does not circulate anymore. So you have a heterologic vaccine against viruses which are heterologic. And if you mix heterologic vaccine and heterologic virus, you might end up with antibody-dependent enhancement, which is something which might really maim or even kill the individual which was vaccinated with this heterologic vaccine. So even if, I don't know, so still we do not have long-term follow-up data on the vaccines, because it really objectively started a year ago. So we do not have like 5-year, 8-year, 10-year follow-up with the vaccine. But we have some predictions, in silico predictions, what the vaccine might cause and how dangerous it might be. So even if they dismiss this in silico prediction, saying it's just from the lab and we do not believe in that, but if you see that you have a vaccine which is not homologous to the individual strains which are circulating, So this is a textbook knowledge which they should definitely have. And if they do not have this knowledge, I don't know what kind of experts they are. So with having this knowledge that each strand is something different, and the vaccine is heterogeneous, so they had immediately stop vaccination, immediately stop it from safety reasons and not mandate it, push it, offer money for getting vaccinated, offer iPhones or Zoom trainers.
I hate to interrupt you, but we will get into the issue of the so-called vaccines with a different group of experts. So in concluding, again, there is no reason for vaccinations because there is no basis for any of the corona measures because the PCR test cannot tell us anything about infections. Is that correct?
PCR test is done in a quantitative way. Can you give some hints if the patient might be really ill with SARS-CoV-2-related disease? Because if you measure like 10 up to 7 copies or 10 up to 8 copies, 10 million copies.
But you're saying it can give you an indication, but it cannot tell you if the patient is really contagious because the virus has entered his cells. Because as Ulrika explained to us, the whole virus doesn't exist anymore when the swab goes into the machine, correct?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Okay. So all the time laboratory data are only indicative data, helping data, and it is the clinical status of the patient, which is at the top of the iceberg. So,
in other words, in and of itself, the PCR test is not enough to tell us whether or not someone is infectious, contagious with COVID-19.
You need
additional help. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Sonia. We're under a little bit of pressure, but I don't want to cut everyone off, anyone off. So if any of you, Anna, Dexter, Virginie, Deepali, if you have any questions, please go ahead.
Yeah, Dr. Sonia, thank you so much for your evidence. I think what is very, very important, and that is for the jury to understand that what has basically happened from the onset of this pandemic, we say pandemic, was that continuous alertness to the statistics. Today, we have actually tested so many positive cases and so forth. And then as a consequence, it then basically sets the people's mindset to say, you know what, yes, it seems like our government is definitely out there for our best interest, which means we need to lock down, we need to adhere, we need to actually put on masks, and we need to ultimately then actually adhere to the social distancing. But my question that I want to pose to you, which is quite crucial, is the statistical numbers that came from this PCR, the Drosten PCR test. So in short, Dr. Sonia, will you then say that all that statistical numbers that has been provided in the audience, the jury has been bombarded on a daily basis, positive, 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 those statistical numbers is incorrect, and there is no way that any public health regulator in any country could have actually used it to justify the lockdown. So that is statistics. Thank you.
So we just collected numbers. So every day in the newspapers, you could read that laboratories have identified this number of positive cases, and it's more than it was yesterday, and blah blah. It was like a continuous fear mongering of the population. Plus, because PCR positivity was a special bonus for the hospitals, because if they had a patient who was suspicious of being SARS-CoV-2 positive, even suspicious, they got a much better reimbursement from the insurance company. So there was no pressure from the hospitals and from the doctors. Everything is so corrupted. It's terrible. So there was no pressure even from the hospitals and doctors for for precise results, because they, if they had a PCR positive individual, not let's call him patient individual, they got three times as much money for him as if he or she was SARS-CoV-2 negative. So they were quite happy because they got more money. The patients were more lucrative for them, and they're better reimbursed by the insurance companies. So there was no pressure, even from the medical audience, for the correctness of the data, because they lived on that, that they have like influx of SARS-CoV-2 positive cases, be it falsely positive or accurately positive. But once the patient had a result like SARS-CoV-2 positive at whatever CT number, it was much better reimbursed by the insurance companies. And this was not only a situation in our country, but it was a situation over there in many, many countries around the world. So, but I did not know if I did not divert from your question a little bit.
So the most important is that when it comes to the statistics that we actually get on a daily basis, that the jury has been bombarded each and every day, that is statistics that we cannot actually take and trust, and we cannot, or will I rather say, the public health regulators or the public health policy makers in the country, there is no way that they could have actually used that to actually justify all these lockdowns. So in short, number one, those statistics cannot be trusted. Number two, the public health policy makers could not have actually used it at all to justify whatever they have implemented. Yes or no, Dr. Sonia?
So the statistics with PCR tests cannot be trusted at all, cannot be trusted at all, because even if a patient was flattened by a truck and was SARS-CoV-2 positive, it was like he went into the statistics like SARS-CoV-2 positive. Then there was a big clash here in this country, a big discussion if it was a patient dying with COVID or of COVID. So so anyone who was COVID, SARS-CoV-2 positive was counted like in the statistics like a case. So it's absolutely impossible to trust any statistics, and the statistics were used only for the government to have a really powerful tool to regulate the society and implement draconian measures and implement lockdowns and implement draconian laws and just restrict the population, because using this tool, these numbers and these false statistics, which are really, they are doctored, they are totally doctored fraudulent. So they use these statistics to regulate the society. They, for example, closed small and medium-sized businesses. They closed schools. So they took damaged many people in the society. So in my eyes, and no one will talk me out of that opinion, that they use SARS-CoV-2, the virus, only as a tool to manage the society in a way they wanted or they planned to. And the first goal was to just mandate vaccines and to jab anyone, whatever the vaccines or the solutions are. And they want to implement much more draconian measures and all these energies.
Hold it. He just asked a simple question. We cannot trust the numbers that were produced through the PCR test.
No, we cannot trust the numbers.
Okay, thank you.
No, we cannot trust the numbers. Anyway, the majority of the statistics was made up on purpose.
Okay, thank you very much.
One question quickly is that you can just say yes or no, and that should be more than sufficient, because you have given quite elaborate evidence. The final follow-up question is that we are talking about a PCR case pandemic, which is not follow the science. Yes or no, doctor?
Yes, PCR pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. No further questions.
Yeah.